This is the Power of Genetics podcast, the podcast designed to help visionary practitioners build a more successful practice, transform more lives, and lead their patients into the future of personalized health. In each episode, I'll interview successful practitioners and leading thought leaders who will share their insights and expertise to help you prepare your practice for what lies ahead. I'm your host, Dr. Yael Jaffe, and now, let's get into today's episode. A big welcome to Dr. Nathan Price. This is quite a coup for me on the Power of Genetics podcast. As you well know, we have a lot of practitioners and clinicians in our podcast, but I've been waiting to talk to Nathan for some time. I'm usually sitting in an audience listening to Nathan talk to me from the stage. So big welcome, Dr. Nathan Price.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to see you again and great to be together.
And I actually had to track Nathan down because I just, as you know, I moved to Seattle 4 months ago and I was under the impression that Nathan was still in Seattle, only to discover that while I was in the process of moving, he scuttled off to New York. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, I moved here about 6 months ago, six, 7 months ago.
About 6 months ago. That's quite a change, Pacific Northwest to New York.
Yeah, it's been a big change in not just geography, but also a little bit in at least my day-to-day and going through a little bit of a change in, not in direction so much, but in kind of focus along the direction I was going. So as you know, I was a professor at the Institute for Systems Biology for many years, was associate director there. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I had actually run a lab joint with Lee Hood, where he had come to me with this when he became chief science officer for Providence. He'd come with this idea of merging our lab groups together because we'd both become really fascinated in this area we call scientific wellness, which is basically how do you study not disease in its late stages, but what leads up to disease, what's happening in the years or decades beforehand, and how do you dive in and try to stop it before it really gets going. Anyway, we'd been very interested in that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what led to my transition because we'd been building up, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, lots of science behind scientific wellness and launched a whole enterprise on that. But about a year and a half ago, so during the pandemic, I got a call from Paul Jacobson, who was the CEO of Thorne. And in essence, seeing if I would come join. And I was almost certain I was going to say no. I was too happy. Like, things were going great. We're doing all this really interesting work. Lovely. Everything was, terrific, all that, all those things. And I was kind of prepared to get into that. And he sort of spun me with one phrase right at the very beginning, which was interesting because I was about to launch into, here are the 3 companies I'm working on launching. And here's the 12 clinical trials we're running. And here's the, all the research and, And, and I get on the phone. The first thing he says to me, he says, the problem with all you academics is you want to have your finger in a million different pies at the same time, and you can't see the one huge opportunity that is staring you in the face.
Oh, that's perfect, right? That's going to get your attention. I love
that. So it stopped me from doing my litany because I couldn't do it after that.
Yeah, like he pulled the carpet out from you. So Nathan, because I know you and I know your history, and we've kind of jumped to the end, and you've kind of already addressed so many of the points I was going to touch, but for those that are listening to the podcast, I'd love to go backwards because undoubtedly you have had some of the greatest impact in the world of scientific wellness, bringing the kind of rigor of science and academia into the world of wellness and how we actually do things. And I think there are not many people who can have a foot in both sides and really kind of keep that level of what I call kind of scientific rigor. But I'd love to go back to the beginning because even for myself, who have been following you for decades, really, I don't actually know your background and I don't know how you landed up in this space. What I love most about this podcast is we get to talk to people who have really changed paradigms, who have been part of such fundamental innovations in healthcare that have kind of set the rest of us on our path. So if you don't mind, indulge us all and go back to the beginning of what did you study? Why? What led you to it? Why did you shift your emphasis? And almost like an intro bio, which is much better than me reading a few lines to everyone.
Sure. So I'm trying to think how far back to go. I'll start really early just with a little anecdote, which is that You know, I was really lucky when I was a little kid to be taught by my grandmother, my father's mother. And it's interesting because, you know, so often I'll, sometimes if I say I was at least partially homeschooled for some of the years, my brother-in-law always retorts to me, which is probably good. He's like, no, you had a live-in tutor, because my grandma was a really great elementary school educator in primary schools in California. She retired and then basically devoted her life to teaching all of us. So I became interested in science kind of through her and at an early age, you know, just reading books and things like that. So then if I fast forward later, I'm doing a PhD at the University of California in San Diego. And it was really based around computational modeling. So how do you, and it was metabolic models in particular. So essentially, how do you study all the molecules that you take into your body, you know, through, you know, for us, that's food, obviously. And you take that in, and then how do you go through all the biochemistry to make that into yourself and the energy you need and so forth. And so we built these like dense computational models. And then I became really interested in applications to medicine. And I had done well in grad school, so I actually applied for faculty job straight out of grad school, which was somewhat unusual. I got a faculty job at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, which was a top 10 engineering school, and I was in chemical engineering there. But I deferred it for 2 years to go learn systems medicine from Lee Hood. And Lee had been a huge hero of mine in science. I'd read all of his stories. And, you know, for people that don't know, right, he won the National Medal of Science from President Obama, he invented automated DNA sequencing. He had major contributions to immunology, which won him the Lasker Prize and a slew of other things, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I had become really interested in that. So anyway, I deferred for 2 years. I went and worked with Lee, got super interested in systems medicine.
Never left. Never left.
Well, I did. I did leave.
Oh, did you? Oh. I
worked there for 2 years on leave from my faculty job at Illinois. So after 2 years, I went and started my lab in Illinois, and it grew. And, you know, after about 3.5 years there, we had, I think it's 17 grad students and 8 postdocs and just kind of big academic enterprise. But all that time, Lee and I had stayed close in touch. And in fact, we had every other week a 6 a.m. call throughout the 4 years just to touch base and talk science, and which was really wonderful. And I would come back to Lee's place out in Montana every summer, and we'd spend a week together. And about after, in the fourth year, Lee's just like, just move back, you know? And just, you know, and so he kind of...
You're delaying the inevitable.
And he had just gotten this $100 million grant from the government of Luxembourg, which was kind of amazing. And anyway, we ended up working that out. I moved back, you know, after 4 years in Illinois and really started working with Lee in earnest. Moved, I think 20 people in the research group came with me.
So we kind
you know, that kind of upped the size of ISB a little bit at the
time. I was going to say, took one of the floors of ISB.
What it really did is shift the number of grad students, because I think we had something like 3, and then after I moved, we had 20 or something like that. So it was like this big shift up in a lot of the young people we had, which was great. And then anyway, so when I was working with Lee, we were primarily working on systems medicine, which is this complex network-based view of what drives medicine. But then in many conversations, Lee and I just were getting more and more interested in what we ultimately called scientific wellness. And it was partly born out of this notion that Lee had really pushed out there, which he calls P4 medicine, which is medicine that's predictive, preventive, personalized, and participatory. Yeah. And we were going around visiting these different hospital systems and talking about it, Lee more than me, but we were both doing it to some degree. And it kind of wasn't going, it were very interesting discussions, people liked it, but it wasn't tangible. And so what we really got together on was, all right, we need to do something that makes this more real, that people can get their minds wrapped around. And we came out with the idea of this thing that we called the 100K Wellness Project, which was, you know, big grand vision of recruit 100,000 people and, you know, measure all these things about them, et cetera, et cetera. And we published a paper kind of announcing that we were going to do this in Science Translational Medicine. And ultimately, we didn't end up doing that exactly, but it led to doing the Pioneer 100, which was a big project we could talk more about. And then that ultimately led to founding Aravale, which led to scientific wellness.
Did the Pioneer 100 precede Aravale? I thought it was done with Aravale, that it was all at the same time, like co-joined. Or did I get my timing wrong on that?
It depends how you... You were more engaged in the actuality of it than like the hindsight of it.
So you mean like years before it was happening, before I actually saw it?
Yeah. So it kind of depends how you we usually talk about the Pioneer 100 and then launching Aravail. But you are correct that we did start a precursor to Aravail that most people don't know about, which was called Wellness Sciences. And so Wellness Sciences was just more of a placeholder company. Like students will often ask me, like, how hard is it to start a company? You're like, starting a company is easy. $500 and, you know.
Exactly. Company, right? Making a successful company. That's a whole different ballgame. Ask Aravail.
Successful company is much hard. Is very hard. Starting a company is easy. So there was this precursor, right? Wellness Sciences. And we did get some seed money. And part of the seed money did help offset costs of the Pioneer 100. It was, the Pioneer 100 was mostly funded by philanthropy. But Wellness Sciences at the time, we had by that point met Clayton Lewis and he had come on. And at that point, I think he was like interim CEO. And we had gotten some money
from
his health venture fund. And so there was a little bit of that, but it was really more just seed money that helped offset some of the costs. And there were a couple employees that were hired in on that, just more learning than anything. But then it wasn't until after we did the Pioneer 100 and kind of figured out, all right, does this look like it's working? Are we learning things? That's the point at which then we launched Aravail, which was, you know, a real company as opposed to
Aravail a collaboration with ISB, or was it a spin-off of ISB?
It was a spin-out company. So it was a spin-out company. It was founded by, Wellness Sciences initially was founded by Lee and me, and then a number of people at ISB were also involved. And then Aravail was a spin-out, basically just evolved from Wellness Sciences with founders me, Lee, and Clayton Lewis, who came on as CEO. I won't go down that rabbit hole. Anyway, a very capable.
I've got a great story about Clayton. So I came to see Aravail from South Africa. I don't know if the story. And I was coming to see the work that you were doing in genetics at Aravail, and I was going to meet Clayton. And I was told when I got off the plane, understanding that I was in Cape Town, South Africa, and it took me about 3,000 hours to get from Cape Town to Seattle, arrive from the airport. I get taken to Clayton's house. I get given a bicycle and a pair of cycling shorts. And the next thing I know is I'm cycling around Seattle on his racing bike. That was like getting to know Clayton, right? And then...
Yeah, keeping up with Clayton is hard too. That guy is...
That's like, it's not like, let's go for lunch, have a cup of coffee and chat about your work. It was like... Here's a bicycle that is a racing bicycle, like, and cycling is not my greatest forte. And we're going to tackle some of the hills of Seattle. And then maybe if we're lucky, we'll like have a drink. And then we landed up with a puncture and we had to call for help. So my whole experience of Clayton, I barely remember anything else about Clayton except our first day. And in fact, I then got to go out for dinner with Lee Hood. Now, Lee Hood for me has always been like, you know, on such a great big pedestal, I can barely see him, you know, in terms of inspiration and just the fundamental change in the world of science. I was invited to have dinner with him, and I remember because it's the strangest things you remember. I ordered steak, which I never order. I think because he did, so I did. And then I remember like being so starstruck. I was like a complete fan thing that I could barely eat. So those are my two Clayton and Lee stories. And I think like when I met you, I was like, no, I can talk to you. You were like, I was okay.
Exactly.
So let's progress. So for those who don't know Aravail, it's such a pity. Let's just stop for a second. Aravail was the dream, really. It was the dream company. And I always talk about Aravail as the gold standard. You know, when we think about our world of scientific wellness and being able to offer an individual a full understanding in a systems biology way of who they are with microbiome, genetics, functional testing, and then to have extraordinary coaches. And I've hired half of them. Some of them, I think most of my staff are all Aravail trained. So just brilliant. Not only were they brilliant clinically, but brilliant from a coaching point of view. have them look after you. It really was, for me, the gold standard in the world for how scientific wellness should be delivered to the individual. And the reason I raise that is that I've always looked up to Arabelle as being, this is how things should be done. And this is long before I launched 3x4. So it was long before I had an attempt at building another business myself. And I'll never forget the day where I got a press release and said, you know, people, you remember moments in your life. And I know it's not comparing like 9/11 or anything like that, but you remember days of where you were. And one of those days for me was Arabelle, where I was notified with the press release that they were closing. And I was heartbroken, and I wasn't the only one. I mean, obviously, I know the Arabelle staff were, but I'm talking about as an external person, because for me, it felt like such a setback in our dream and our vision. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I felt very much the same way. I knew it was coming, obviously, a little bit before, because we were scrambling like crazy to make it not happen, literally, even in. And that's why the announcement ended up being so abrupt was, you know, literally until, you know, the day before, we were still scrambling to try and save it in various ways. And so, yeah, so it was really tough. And I do feel the same way. And when we look at how much we learned, so we had about 5,000 people that went through Arabelle. And the big problem we had, the fundamental problem we had is it took so much education and time to get someone to sign up. Once people came in, for the most part, people really liked
the
program.
They loved it. Yeah.
And we have really good health outcomes with people in terms of like biological age and clinical markers and some diseases that were avoided and, you know, a number of things like that, which I could get into later. And so when I look at that, and then we've published a slew of papers on the, you know, for the people who gave research consent for their de-identified data to be used. But the amount that we could have pulled out of that endeavor, if we had really gotten it out to, you know, 100,000 plus people as we had hoped, I mean, it would have given us the early warning signs for most major human diseases. And it becomes partly a numbers and a time game. But the amount we've been able to learn off it so far has been incredible. And it's already, and even abbreviated to the 5,000, it was still the largest, you know, effort of its kind with that amount of dense data on a population of not selected for a particular disease. And so I do look at it in part as a setback. You know, I view it a little bit more like a tragedy in some ways, which is a little melodramatic.
I would agree with that.
The opportunity cost was massive. Now, that said, we learned a tremendous amount from it. The people who were there, like you said, have gone, a bunch of them to you, but a bunch of them, you know, to really great organizations all across the field. And I think that's been very beneficial. And I think we can learn a lot about, you know, what was good there and what didn't work. And honestly, that was partly the drive for, you know, what I'm doing now, having gone to Thorne, because it's not Arabelle, but it is a recreation of scientific wellness in a sense that I think, you know, where the business model is much better and the potential for growing it is much larger. And so it was part of that.
So intriguing. Yeah. That's like a teaser. All right, before we get to that, oh my God, you like say that to me. Now I'm like, that's not fair. So when I started 3x4, I spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about Arabelle, because my sense was, if you couldn't make Arabelle successful with the incredible depth of talent that we had, plus all the computational, I mean, I remember meeting with your team and I was like, I've never met people who've got like a PhD in genetics and a PhD in computational science. Like, where did these people come from? So I was just, you know, the extraordinary quality of individuals that you had. And when I was thinking of starting 3x4, I was like, what can I do that you guys couldn't do? Like, why do I think I can build a successful company with Arabelle? So I've been wanting to ask this question for such a long time, so please indulge me. But if you had to give some advice, just a little bit, about perhaps a couple of things that were done wrong and a couple of things that can do better that someone like myself, and there's many others who will be listening to this, can take away. And then I'd love to talk about your new work, because if you're telling me, I'd love to hear what's coming next. Because as I say, you're always at the forefront. You're always pushing the boundaries. So I'd love to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, happy to do all those things. So with Arabelle, So redoing it. So there's a number of factors of how to do it differently. And some of those have to do with differences in strategy. And some of them have to do with differences in the world today compared to when it was then. So some benefit has already happened because a lot of the assays and the measurements you can do much cheaper now than you could do it when we launched therapy, because the world's moved forward. Technology is better. Sequencing is better. We understand more of how to do actionable things. So that's a table stakes one. And there are certain technologies that I'm really excited about now. I can't get into all of them, but that are going to allow for some of these measures to be done potentially just much, much cheaper. And we're going through some, you know, validation steps around some of these things right now, but it's, you know, there's a lot of potential. Another big one, and it seemed like a good idea at the time, you know, so I definitely don't want to come across, you know, we're doing lessons learned. This is, you know,
yeah, I love lessons learned. And I appreciate it.
Is what it is.
Hindsight is 2020, right? Yeah.
But one big problem as we got in was that we weren't connected into healthcare. Now, initially, we chose not to do that because we wanted to be faster, nimble. We were in the wellness space. And we thought eventually we can tie into healthcare downstream once we've built up something. But we didn't want to get tied down into bureaucracy where a startup needs to be quick.
I know that well, yeah.
And that all made sense. But a big problem, and the regulatory space has also loosened up a little bit, so it's a little better now. But the big problem was that we had so much information that we couldn't tell people. And that and you couldn't be really, you know, so you're kind of telling them about scientific wellness, but it's a little bit squishy. When in fact, you know, you get this huge genome sequence, the early people got their whole genome sequence, and we have a ton of really interesting information that we're not allowed to give back to people. And so it made the value proposition
to the end user harder. Yeah, that was with my perception, I mean, yeah.
You know, and sometimes people would be like, I know you must know this, tell it to me. And we would have to say, you know, we're actually legally not allowed to tell you that. And, you know, I don't want to get, you know, too far down.
That was always my perception that because you were collecting so much extraordinary data, plus the ability to analyze that data in the back end, but the experience of the user was comparatively, I'm going to use the word comparatively superficial compared to what you were experiencing. And I think that was the challenge of Arrival, is that you were actually a scientific wellness company with a kind of a coaching component. And I think that the experience for the user wasn't anything compared to how extraordinary what was happening in the back end. That was my interpretation. I don't know if
that's right. We were always trying to push and, you know, and open that space. And if we had been connected with physicians more deeply, or a system, that would have been better, because physicians are able to give this kind of information. Yeah. And we did try to do that at the end, but we weren't able to pull it off from a timing perspective. So that's another lesson, which is just the ability to give people back more of that kind of information, I think would be important.
One more thing, pre-COVID, right? It was pre-COVID.
That is another big external impetus, because COVID has really brought wellness to the forefront, because we know how important it is to have health resiliency. It makes a big difference in outcomes in COVID, as we're all very aware of. And the other big thing is that COVID
virtual. Yeah.
To go virtual, which, I mean, we would be doing hardly any telehealth now if it wasn't for COVID.
Exactly.
Now, you got 10 years of acceleration in 6 months, and the system got used to the fact that if you go for it, you can actually innovate. And we got vaccines for COVID in a year. If, you know, if it hadn't been COVID, anything else would have taken 10 years, you know. And so it was just this insult into the system that's shaking it up. So it's a perfect moment to get into that. And then the one other point I'll make is that there's also just a time lag in what we were learning. So for example, we figured out how to do biological age out of the data clouds and for different organ systems. Things like that.
Oh, wow.
But we figured that out after Aravail had collapsed, shortly after. The week that Aravail went down, one of my very favorite papers that didn't get any attention because it was a weak air valve came down, showed that you could predict people who were going through AirVale, whether or not they could lower their LDL cholesterol levels was very predictable from the genome. And HDL is the same. Hemoglobin A1C, I think, is the same. We're in the middle of a trial.
A paper on your name. If I search for it, will I find it?
Yeah. Yeah. 2019. It's in Scientific Reports. One of those where you send a high tier journal, it takes forever for someone to actually read the paper because it doesn't fit in a box yet. But I love this paper because it shows that the outcome of lifestyle interventions is often predictable by genetics. And what it showed was that if your genes predicted that you would have, so let's take two people and they have exactly the same LDL cholesterol, our healthcare system treats them the same today. One is high, but their genome predicts they're high. And the other is high and their genome predicts they're low. So one has a gap and one doesn't. If you've got that gap, we saw that people were able to lower their LDL cholesterol by lifestyle a lot. The bottom, and it worked for the bottom
40%. Yeah.
And the upper 40% of people on this score, you know, where there wasn't a gap, we saw no statistical change.
Beautiful. You know.
So
I love that.
That is an entirely new variable class in medicine that is not used today, which is the gap between the genetic prediction of your markers and the actual number. And it was radically informative. And anyway, so that's one of
the. I have to tell you, I know it's probably not that paper is exactly the work that we're doing. Like that is that I've got to go find the paper. But so just a teaser, because this is not the place or time for it, we can maybe talk offline, is that what you're talking about, we've built for fitness. Hmm. Where we know that there's a bucket, we talk about two buckets, and you've got an athlete and you've got a genetic contribution and say to injury risk. And depending on what your genetic contribution is or to power, let's say power, we know that you've got to fill your bucket up differently in order to reach the same goal. And we've been working on something called the genetic modifier algorithm, which is how do you calculate what that difference is in what you have to do to fill your bucket up to the same. So we should probably take that offline. Super exciting.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We'll talk about that.
But it's exactly the same concept. Exactly. Except you're kind of going LDL down and we're going kind of a fitness goal up. Okay. To get back, as I can see this could land up going down a very deep rabbit hole. But Nathan, tell us a little bit about where you are now and where you believe we are now and what can we look forward to in the future? Because as I said, you know, you are my futurist in this space. And I would love to hear where, I mean, happy to hear about the work you're doing now, but if you'd prefer not to, can you just tell us a little bit about where do you think we are and where do you think we're going?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. So, well, I'll start with kind of where I'm at now. So as we were getting to at the very beginning, so I made this leap from, you know, a nonprofit, you know, running all these trials, the spin out of AirVale, all that stuff. And I ended up accepting the job offer from Paul Jacobson. And basically the, you know, just to come back to that. So, you know, he said the problem with academics and, you know, you can't see an opportunity because you're involved in too many things. But, you know, the other thing he said is, look, I'll run business, you run science, you know, and we'll build the greatest healthy aging company in the history of the world. And we have a long way to go to prove that out, right? But you got to have an ambition. I'm sure there's a bunch of other places that would say you know, that's them or whatnot. But I thought that was an interesting mission. And what he said is that you've got to take all these pieces that you've built in scientific wellness, all this stuff you've learned, and you've got to tie it up into one thing and make it all work in the real world so that you can get it, you know, you can get it out there. And of course, we had, you know, aimed to do that with AirVale, but some of the big differences are with AirVale, we tried to jump kind of right to the end because we were trying to generate these huge data clouds. We were going to recruit enough people. And we always knew we were going to go through sort of this valley of death, which was, can you get enough people? Can you have enough to show them that's fascinating and interesting? And then emerge on the other side and learn from that incredible amount of data and just power the thing and kind of get it all at once. But the problem with that approach is it's quite a while before you're profitable. And so, you know, we weren't able to get through the valley, or no one believed in it enough, you know, to say, hey, I'm going to give you, you know, who knows,
100 million to get through to you. Yeah.
You know, 100 million, you know, to get through to profitability or whatnot. So we're doing it very differently. So Thorn is already an established brand, works with 45,000 physicians. It has 4 million customers. It's a profitable company. It makes money and it has a business model. And so what we're doing now then is innovating all under profitability, which is important because that means we have long-term staying power and we have a big group and we have a high reputation amongst, you know, doctors use us all the time. And when Paul was recruiting me, I was sitting in my doctor's office and I looked around and it was just tons of Thorn products in every direction. I said, well, you're doing well with my doctor here. you know, they seem to like it. So it's got that. But my coming in, so Thorn has been a really high quality supplement maker. It's got, I think, maybe the most NSF, you know, certified products on the market. Anyway, it's got all this background in what it does. But Thorn's ambition is not ultimately, you know, Thorn doesn't want to be a supplement company. Thorn wants to be a healthy aging scientific wellness company. And in fact, if you go to thorn.com, you know, the banner there is now personalized scientific wellness.
Oh, wow.
And they hired me, Lee's chair of our scientific advisory board. And so as we're looking at that, what we're doing is from a very different standpoint in terms of business model, but growing it more organically and from a standpoint of a stable company that's, you know, there for the long run, is recreating a number of tests. And we have some of those already. So we have our microbiome test. In fact, we have a new innovation that's launching here in, I think, a month or so commercially, which we're excited about, which is our microbiome wipe. This is, so, you know, every time you do your microbiome, you know, it's the same thing. You either have a bucket or a paper. You have to poop in the bucket. You have to scoop it up. It's like, you got to put it in the seat. It's not great, right? It's still, even at Thorn, it's our number one selling test, but it's not the greatest thing in the world. So two of the guys that are involved in the company, so this predated me, but this was Joel Dudley, you know, who was...
I didn't know Joel was involved in Thorn. Okay.
Yes. Joel was the co-founder of Longevity. So I initially moved to become CEO of Longevity. And then Longevity was purchased by Thorn. And then we IPO'd the company 6 months ago as Thorn Health Tech, which is this joint enterprise of Thorn, which was a supplement company, and Longevity, which is a health AI company. We've merged those together to form Thorn Health Tech, which is a personalized scientific wellness company, which is about testing, teaching, transforming, and then iterating and using AI algorithms, all this kind of stuff to personalize a scientific wellness journey. So the gut health, so Joel Dudley and Chris Mason, who's another guy, is a professor at Cornell. Those were the two scientific co-founders at Longevity. I'd actually tried to recruit Joel to Aravail, and then I didn't end up picking him. And then he ended up going back across the coast. He met Paul Jacobson. They founded Longevity. Anyway, after Aravail fell, he had
a little bit incestuous, there. But it's working. Yeah.
That's a little bit incestuous, but you know.
But it's working. It's working.
We're in a field. And so anyway, the wipe lets you, it's just what it sounds like. It's basically
a wipe.
It's made out of a special polymer. It biodegrades away, and then you can preserve the DNA. We've done tests on this. We have our paper just accepted. It'll come out.
Amazing.
Literature shortly, just about accepted. The minor tweaks we have to do. But anyway, so we've got that kind of thing. So then with Thorn, and that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of testing. We're working on a whole bunch of kind of next gen stuff right now that will come out later. But basically, what we're doing is just increasing the level of information we can get to then personalize. And one nice thing with Thorn is Thorn has about 200 different products, you know, different natural products, all of which have extensive data behind them. And so the way I think about it is the products are kind of like keys on a keyboard, but what you're trying to do with the intelligence, you know, system is what's the music that you
want
to
tune? Yeah.
What's the tune? What's the issue that an individual has? And you can get into that, whether it's nicotinamide riboside or, you know, which is involved in, you know, NAD boosting, which, you know, has shown life and health span extension in animal models, for example. And then we have human, you know, studies on safety and that it works functionally. And then you can look at things like quercetin, right, which is an anti-senolytic, berberine, which is important for metabolic health, on and on and on, right? There's a long tail of these. There's this prebiotic plus that we've got that is pretty cool, which is these two-dimensional printed discs where you actually print on their bacteriophages. So you clear out some space in your micro, because most of the time if you take a probiotic, it flows through you because it has to out-compete the bacteria there. So this thing actually has bacteriophages to kill off some of the bad bacteria, open a space. And then you include probiotics and prebiotics that you know that they grow best on, and you put them all together and you can get transformation in the gut. And if that's the direction cool. that you can go, you can do it, it's et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so the idea though, is because they've got this whole production line and the great chemists and people that understand that space, then as we work on the testing and we start putting this together and we can build these digital twin models, which we don't have enough time to get into today. We've done an amazing one on brain health that's going to come out
later.
But that's a longer conversation, but it's okay. Totally transformed my view of Alzheimer's disease, actually almost entirely from what I thought before. And so anyway, that's a teaser I haven't.
I keep on throwing them at me. It's fine. I'm making notes. I won't forget.
Go down that rabbit hole, but we have shown it to a number of leading physicians in that space recently. And it's, it's just super fascinating. So what we're doing then is building this. So ultimately, what we'll get in terms of personalized scientific wellness are these, you know, deep tests, algorithms that look at that data and make personalized recommendations, and then tied into a large and growing product line that helps to make a difference for people in those spaces. And we'll, of course, also have lifestyle recommendations and all those kind of things.
Right.
You can't really achieve wellness without those kind of things.
No, you still need to eat some food and do some exercise and manage your stress and build some resilience and all of that.
You got to do all those things.
Yeah.
But what's so tantalizing about this whole space is that when you look at the work that scientists have done in different animal systems, you can, including us, just, you know, in some cases, you can modify a lot about their biology and their wellness and their health span and their lifespan. It's all malleable. And so, of course, the question is, how do we get benefits from that for ourselves? And how do we do that in a really safe way? And then how do we deliver these things to people in a form that's economic, you know, that's affordable for people, and that, you know, gives an ability to
experience and wow, and then, I'm very excited to see where this is going to go. And just this, as I say, could be a whole conversation itself, but thank you for giving some insight. I'm going to be watching very closely. I have a million questions for you offline, but I think before we run out of time, I'm going to just bring us full circle to finish off, and I'm going to ask the question, power of genetics. Where do you think genetics lives in this world that you've been talking about?
So I think genetics is really important. Obviously, it's a blueprint to our bodies. And, two things. One is that genetics doesn't live in isolation, because your environmental exposures, your lifestyle, I think genetics is particularly powerful when it's combined with dynamically changing analytes that also, reflect where you're at. And the example I gave of the LDL cholesterol or HDL cholesterol is the same in the opposite direction is a good one. So genetics tells you something to inform where you're at, but it's the combination of that data that's really most powerful. That's kind of how I see genetics playing.
Well, it sounds like we're much in agreement. You know, the first 15 years of my career were all about SNPs and code. And then I had this huge epiphany going, it's just one piece of the puzzle. And I call it the insight and action puzzle. And it's like insight doesn't live in isolation. You can't look at it out of context. You have a look, it gives you some insight, and then you go and it gives you an idea of where to start looking. But then, of course, functional testing and everything else that comes with it is really where you make your kind of absolute decisions and recommend, where you fine tune those recommendations. So also all my training is shifted into what I call nutrigenetics and nutrigenomics, which is, study the code, gain the insight, understand kind of who you are and how you respond. But really then it's about how do we change gene expression? How do we switch on those genes? We want to switch off some. And how do we measure that? And that's where functional testing. So we've done a huge amount of work around integrating functional testing and genetic testing, because what we want practitioners to understand is how to use both together and not in isolation. So we're actually about to run an expert masterclass series of 5 weeks with some great teachers. And every single session is genetics and functional, just like whether it's hormones is one and organic acids and micro and to really, because that's where the answers lie. So I think we're very much on the same page when it comes to that.
Absolutely. Well, and then the one other thing I would say about the genetics is just the other piece that I think is really important is because the research enterprise has been so focused on disease, we understand genetics in the language of disease primarily, right? You have Alzheimer's genes or diabetes genes or so forth. And what we really need, and this is one of the pieces that underlies scientific wellness, is an understanding of genetics about what they say about how your system most optimally functions. And that's a very different approach.
Yeah.
And it's totally necessary. You know, there's this example of a Native American tribe that, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, right? And anyway, someone does a study like, oh, you know, they've got diabetes genes. No, they don't have, you know, I mean, it does manifest.
There's no diabetes genes. It's all upstream. It's all upstream.
What they have are genes that are optimized for a particular lifestyle.
Right.
That was the way they were living. And so anyway, that just.
Exactly. That was my whole conversation with David Kilmer. So it was evolutionary biology, right? So that's the genes they've got. They're not good or bad. They just, they kind of match with the environment. It's very much why I've moved away from the concept of a single SNP or disease. So I have no conversation around single SNPs, and I have no disease conversations. And that's, I guess, my background from, you know, following yourself and me and IFM, obviously, and JF, is that, you know, we need to be thinking about polygenic environments, and we need to be thinking in a more kind of functional way, which is, you know, upstream cellular, no disease. So sounds like we're all heading in the same direction. I could talk to you for hours. I'm going to have to bring you back in another time and hear more about how things are going. But I just, yeah, it's kind of been a personal joy for me listening to talk. And I just wanted to thank you very much for taking the time to spend with us today. And I'm sure everyone feels the same way, that we'd like you to come back and give us another deep dive into the work that's happening at Thorne and how you're addressing some of the challenges.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Wonderful to be with you. And yeah, happy to do it again sometime.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you for listening to the Power of Genetics podcast, brought to you by 3x4 Genetics. For more episodes, please visit 3x4genetics.com/podcast. And if you are a licensed health practitioner who would like to apply to join our network of over 1,000 like-minded visionary practitioners, please visit 3x4genetics.com/apply.